Okay. Good afternoon, everyone.
Welcome
to the New Jersey Association of Museums Connections Program, Me Too and Museums, Understanding and Addressing Sexual Harassment and Gender Discrimination. I'm Saskia Schmidt, Programming Chair for NJAM, and we're pleased to gather with museum and cultural organization colleagues from across the state to share, listen, learn, and support each other. The structure of these conversations is informal, and we are recording the program, and if you don't want to appear in the recording, please turn your video camera off. The chat is open for you to post questions, comments, and add links to resources, so please do feel free to use the chat for that purpose and check out the resources, which I am going to post shortly. You'll find links to the NJAM website and the NCPH, National Council on Public History, and AASLH, American Association for State and Local History Survey. That is something our speaker will talk about later. We encourage you to support NJAM by becoming a member. See our website for more information at njmuseums.org. And also our AAPP program, which Kiki will be talking about later. For those who would like to continue the conversation after this program is over, we're extending the program by 15 minutes for an optional informal discussion, and it will not be recorded. So on that note, I'd like to introduce the NJAM Artifact Assessment Program Chair, Kiki Michael. She will speak briefly about this free program offered to New Jersey museums and cultural organizations. Okay, Kiki, you can take it away.
Thank you, Saskia.
You're welcome.
So, NJAM offers a free program called the Artifact Assessment Program to museums and historical organizations wishing to assess the policy, management, and care of their collections. This program was founded in 2015 to assist in developing and maintaining professional quality care and access to art and cultural and historical artifacts and science specimens held in their trust. For more information, please visit our website or send an email to aapcoordinator@gmail.com. A link to where you can download the application and a link with more information will be posted in the chat as well. Thank you. Next up is Claudia Ocello, Museum Consultant and NJAM Board Member.
Thank you so much. Before I introduce our speaker, I wanted to begin by acknowledging that New Jersey Association of Museums stands on the ancestral lands of the Lenape. We pay respects to their elders past and present. Please take a moment to consider the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that bring us here together today. So I'm really excited to welcome our speaker today, Dr. Mary Rizzo. She is Assistant Professor of History at Rutgers University Newark, where she teaches public history, urban history, and digital humanities. She's an advisor to the Queer Newark Oral History Project and curator of the exhibit At Home in Newark, Stories from Queer Newark, and the founder of the Chicory Revitalization Project, which uses poetry to spur conversation around place and social justice. Now, lest you think she's a pure academic, she's not. She has worked in museums. Before joining the Rutgers faculty, she spent a decade working as a public historian in New Jersey, being a curatorial assistant at the Rockingham Historic Site to being associate director of the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. And her book just came out, like hot off the press. It's called Come and Be Shocked, Baltimore Beyond John Waters and the Wire. It's from Johns Hopkins University Press. Thank you, you showed it. She showed it to you in case you want to order it. She is a native New Jerseyan, so I do wanna make sure that you know that. We're happy to welcome her here today to talk with us about this important topic and the study, the survey that she has worked on with those two organizations, National Council for Public History and American Association for State and Local History. So I'm gonna turn it over to Mary.
Awesome. Thank you. And I want to thank Saskia and Claudia for inviting me here today to do this program and to talk to you about the survey that we're just launching and looking for people to participate in. And I'm really delighted that Stephanie Rowe, who is the director of the National Council on Public History, is also able to join us today. And we'll talk a little bit about NCPH as an organization and its interest in these issues of sexual harassment and gender discrimination and how it fits into that organization's mission. So let me share my screen very quickly. Okay, great. So let me start out by saying maybe what's obvious and part of the reason why you're probably signed up for this program, why you're here today. You know, Me Too has become a highly visible issue in all areas of our public life, right? And museums are no different. So over the last several years, we've heard a lot of discussion about sexual harassment and gender discrimination, particularly sexual harassment, in a variety of different fields and workplaces, right? So we're probably most familiar with the kind of revelations of Hollywood misdoings by very powerful men. But the Me Too conversation has really spread far beyond that and has spurred conversations in all different kinds of areas of work. And museums and public history have not been immune to that. But what's been interesting, I think, is that the conversation in museums has often focused more on the a museum's role in exhibiting work by people who maybe have been accused of sexual harassment or be seen as predators. So there was a great program actually a couple of years ago that NJAM did that I attended up at the Newark Museum by Monica Zimmerman of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. And she talked about how that gallery dealt with the fallout of an exhibition that they had planned and had done around the artist Chuck Close, who was revealed to be a serial harasser soon after that exhibit opened. And that was a really great conversation that touched on how do museums deal with these issues in terms of its interface with the public, right? And I think that's certainly very important for us to think about, but we also need to turn that lens on ourselves, right? So we have to think about the institutions that we represent and how they are allowing a culture that protect sexual harassers, or they are creating a culture where gender discrimination is something that happens. So these are difficult topics, but we need to really examine ourselves and our institutions if we want to create spaces where this is no longer happening. And I'll talk about why I think that that's really important. And we have clear evidence that sexual harassment and gender discrimination happen in the world of public history. When I say public history, I'm talking very broadly. A lot of museums, certainly a lot of museums that you all work for or work with would be included in my very broad definition of public history, but also libraries, archives, educational institutions, and so on. So we know that these issues are happening, right? In 2017, the National Park Service conducted a survey and found that 39% of its workforce had experienced harassment or discrimination on the job, 39%. The year before, respondents reported that over 10% of them had experienced sexual harassment, almost 20% reported gender-based harassment, and almost 1% reported actual sexual assault. So these are really troubling numbers within the National Park Service, but it's not just the National Park Service. In 2018, 5 women who were employed at the Mattress Factory Art Museum in Pittsburgh reported sexual harassment, assault, and rape by a male coworker. When that employee left, other employees actually filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board because they alleged that the museum, the gallery, had not taken their complaint seriously and had retaliated against them for discussing these issues. And then the last example that I'll mention, but there are plenty, right, is one from earlier this year. Even though 2020 feels like it's lasted for 500 years, this was actually only earlier this year. The New York Times reported that Joshua Helmer, who was accused of harassment at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, became the director of a different museum where an intern accused him of harassment, and suggesting that there was a clear pattern, not only of abuse, but of institutions protecting this man who was known to be a harasser, right? But just like an iceberg, this is only the tip of the problem, right? But these high profile incidents don't tell us everything that's going on, because most incidents are not reported. Most incidents are not high profile enough to get in the New York Times. So we know that there is a culture of sexual harassment and gender discrimination that's being allowed to exist in museums and public history institutions. So let me play devil's advocate. I assume that because you're in this program, you think that this is a problem, but let me play a devil's advocate. Why should we care? Right? Why is this a problem that we need to address in museums? So what I would say is one of the key reasons why we need to address this is because sexual harassment and gender discrimination undermine all of the efforts that museums have been doing in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Right? Now, I can't see all of you, but you know, I'm guessing that most of your institutions have been doing something around DEI over the last few years. It's become a critical topic in museums. And for those of you who are just at the ASLH conference, which was just happening virtually over the last few days, DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, was an incredibly key theme throughout the whole conference, right? So we're thinking about these issues, but if you're thinking about diversity, equity, inclusion without thinking about sexual harassment and gender discrimination, then you are undermining your own efforts, right? Because when sexual harassment and gender discrimination occur, it sends a message that some people aren't welcome in your institution, right? It sends a message that there are certain workers who are not welcome there. And conversely, that there are other people who are welcome to do whatever they want, right? And we know that sexual harassment and gender discrimination tends to disempower and marginalize people. And it disempowers and marginalizes women and men of all races, gender identities, and sexual orientations, right? So I think that that's key. This is not just an issue that is affecting women. It's really affecting everyone across the board, but very differently depending on your identity. And that's something that we'll get to and something that our survey is hoping to get some data about. And gender discrimination and sexual harassment are also violations of workers' rights. And so I think that that's really important for me as well. In the public history world, which is what the world that I'm most familiar with, public historians have been advocates for more equitable working conditions in a variety of ways. So we've been talking a lot about why you need to pay your interns, for example, that is only the only way that we can have equitable working institutions, right? But when we don't deal with sexual harassment and gender discrimination, we are also ensuring that the diversity of our field is weakened, because we know that it is excluding certain people and pushing people out of the field as well. So how do we define gender discrimination and sexual harassment? You can read, I'm not going to read this long slide to you. I apologize for its text heaviness. There are really no good images that you can use for a presentation on gender discrimination and sexual harassment. So you'll see more text than images. But what I wanted to point out here, this is not the only definition that we could possibly have, right? And we could have a conversation about what's missing from this definition, but it is a working definition that we can use to have a conversation, right? And what I think is important about this is that it really suggests the range of issues that we are talking about when we talk about sexual harassment and gender discrimination, right? And that includes everything from physical touching and sexual assault to misgendering people to derogatory comments, both online and in person. So it really suggests the wide range of activities that we need to be thinking about as falling under this issue. The one thing that this doesn't necessarily make clear that I want to really emphasize is that these are intersectional issues, right? So a woman of color may experience discrimination in the workplace differently from a white a woman coworker, right? So a woman of color may be harassed, paid less, evaluated more harshly, or passed over promotion because of the combination of her sex and her race working together. And that's what we mean by intersectionality. And I think it's really critical that we keep that in mind, that our experiences are always at the intersection of all of those identities, and they all may be at play in our experiences. And so I'm very passionate about this issue, in part because I've experienced it myself, right? So I've been a victim of sexual harassment and gender discrimination, and I've written about this a little bit. But I do want to just talk very briefly about two experiences that I had over the course of my career. And these experiences did not obviously dissuade me from being a public historian. They didn't force me out of the field, but it's certainly affected me quite deeply in some ways. And we know that there are people who have been forced out of the field because of incidents that have happened to them. So I'll just be brief about this. But the first incident that I can really remember is when I was 19 years old and I was an intern for a nonprofit public history organization in New Jersey. My boss was a white man who was in his 30s, and he hired me for this position. And he repeatedly made sexually suggestive comments to me in the office at work. There were a lot of them, but you know, one I remember is he suggested that we quote unquote try out some mattresses. So they were pretty clear sexually suggestive comments. When my internship ended, he took me out to dinner, which I thought was like a thank you dinner, like for all the great work that I had done. But then he propositioned me at the dinner. So that made me feel really awful. Like wasn't my intellect, the work that I did had no meaning, no value. What was important was how I looked and my availability to him, or at least what he thought was my availability to him. So it made me feel quite ignored. So that was the first incident. And then very different incident is many years later, right? I was in a more senior position in the field of public history and I was working for a white woman who was well known for her favoritism towards male employees, right? So I was in a senior position in this organization. I had a PhD. I was an experienced public historian. But even though all those things were true, she would never accept my opinion as being correct until a man in the office backed me up. And she would like literally call men into the office and be like, let me ask you this question. And they would say the same thing I just said, and then she would believe it, right? She refused to give me any training in support of my job. So, you know, I was very interested in learning more about fundraising, and she was like, oh, you'll just figure that out. And then the final blow was when she was retiring and I was the obvious sort of successor in the organization. But she told me that I wasn't quote unquote tough enough to be the boss, which is something that I took to mean that my gender, right? Because I was a woman, was a problem, even though she was also a woman, but it was also my management style, which was much more collaborative than hers. So it didn't speak toughness in the way that someone else's management style might speak. So, and she hinted that she had told the search committee the same thing, right? So I didn't get that job. Now, in neither of those cases did I report what happened to me to anyone, right? Except to my friends. In the first instance, I was very young, so I actually had like kind of no idea that what happened to me was a problem, right? I was like 19, it was a long time ago. I was like, oh, I don't know, I don't really think this is a big deal. And I didn't see this as my career at that point. So I was like, well, whatever, it's an internship, you know, I leave. It's not a big deal. And there was an HR person, but he was like an older guy, and I just couldn't imagine like going to talk to him about this anyway. In the second example, right, I talked to my friends and my family about this, and they were like, look, you're going to get the job as director, just let it go, right? It's not worth making a big deal about it. And at the same time, the HR person had retired during that period that this was happening, and there wasn't a replacement. And that director had made sure that none of the staff had relationships with the board members. So, which now I see as a tactic of ensuring that there's no one that, you know, your staff is going to go to complain. So there's no HR person, no relationship with the board. So who would I have complained to anyway? And that particular incident really undermined my confidence in myself and set me back in terms of my earning potential for quite a number of years. So it did have real material effects in my life. So I'm telling these stories to you just to give you a sense of the range of what happened to one person in New Jersey, where, you know, you all are, I assume. And I'm guessing that in your heads, you've got like a bunch of stories that you can tell, which we'll get to the opportunity for you to tell some of those stories in our survey. But I think it's important for us to understand how this looks, right? So in 2018, because of the rising interest in Me Too, NCPH, National Council on Public History, began to get involved in engaging with these issues, particularly through our Diversity and Inclusion Task Force. And so we held a session at our 2018 conference in Las Vegas, where we addressed some of these issues, and we asked people to anonymously talk about their experiences and what had happened to them over the course of their careers as public historians. So this slide is a little overview of some of what folks said. So again, I think it gives us a good sense of the range of issues that we're talking about here. But that discussion really convinced us that there's a problem in our field of public history that needed to be addressed, and that NCPH, as a national organization of public historians, was one logical place where we could begin to address these issues. So at this point, maybe I'll turn it over to Stephanie to talk a little bit about NCPH and the organization's interest in this.
Sure. I would say my personal interest in this work, I mean, aside from being a woman who's had her own experiences in the field of museums and public history, started actually through a group of executive directors I have access to that are part of the American Council of Learned Societies, who began talking about how these issues manifested themselves at annual meetings and annual conferences. And many of those groups started doing surveys of attendees at their annual meetings over time to understand sort of the full range of experiences people had. And so we sort of took our lead from those groups, who are much larger and more adequately staffed than our organization. But their work really stopped with sort of exploring this topic as it relates to the association's planning. And they weren't really talking about how these issues manifested themselves in the field, because most of their members work in colleges and universities, which have their own sort of more uniform support systems, reporting mechanisms, whether they work adequately or not, those things exist. And so NCPH, we started sort of talking informally with our Diversity and Inclusion Task Force and with our colleagues at the American Association for State and Local History to think about, how do we tackle this question when our members work in such diverse places? Some of our members at NCPH work at colleges and universities. Some work at museums or historical societies of all sizes, right? So some have HR departments. Some don't. Some don't even have staff. And then NCPH also has a huge membership of independent consultants or folks who do consulting work as part of firms. And we have a huge membership of graduate students. So all of those sort of work environments, from internships to consulting work, to whatever the size of your, you know, nonprofit institution is, come with their own sets of challenges and weaknesses and opportunities for exploitation. So I think early on, we kind of made the assumption that the most vulnerable populations might be the graduate students and the interns. And I started doing some work with the graduate program where we are housed in Indianapolis, with the graduate students there to sort of help prepare them for difficult workplace situations and where to sort of think ahead about how to get support when you need it and when you might not have access to an HR department or a good relationship with a supervisor. But then as people in our community started making more and more disclosures, we realized that our assumptions about the most vulnerable populations may have been a little oversimplified. And so that's where this survey effort comes forward. So I guess Mary, I'll shoot it back to you.
Let me unmute myself. That's great. Thank you. And so I know that we are getting close to the time for our breaking into our discussion groups. And we also have a poll that I think we can do right before the discussion groups start. But let me talk a little bit about what we're trying to do in the Gender Discrimination Sexual Harassment Committee that that is working with NCPH or through NCPH and the American Association for State and Local History. So we're doing a lot of different things to address this issue. The one that I am most interested in getting you guys involved with is our survey. So what's been very clear, and as Stephanie suggested, is we don't actually have a lot of data about this. And because public history takes place in so many different kinds of workplaces and sites, there's no one good place where we know where people have gathered the data that we're looking for. And so in order to understand who is most vulnerable and how we can address those vulnerabilities, we thought that a survey, an anonymous survey, would be the best approach, right? This is the National Anonymous Survey that we are doing. You can take the survey. There's a link there. I believe the link is in the chat as well. I just want to say a couple things about the survey before we run out of time here. Please take the survey, please share the survey. And when you click on that link to go into the survey, what you're going to see is a good amount of introductory material. And please don't let that scare you off, right? There's a lot of text that explains a lot of what we're talking about today, why we're doing this, who are we to do this, what are we trying to, what are we going to do with this data, why is it important? So I think, you know, it's important information, but you can certainly skim through it. So don't get freaked out if you have to click next like three times before you get to the first actual question. The survey is lengthy for obvious reasons. So you don't have to do it in one sitting. You can go back to it. So if you start it, and also these are difficult issues. So it may bring up some emotional stuff. So maybe you need to like start it and then step away. Right? And there are resources out there. This slide includes RAIN sexual abuse hotline. But in any case, you can go back and take the survey over the course of time. So what you're going to see is that the survey begins by asking you to define sexual harassment and gender discrimination. And then it asks you whether you've experienced it. And it gives you some options. So there are little boxes that you can click, but there is the opportunity for you to describe up to 5 incidents. You don't have to describe 5. You can decide that you don't want to describe any in detail. You could decide that there's only one that you really want to talk about. All of this information is really useful to us. It is an anonymous survey. So please, please, please do not give us any information that will identify you or anyone else. This is not a reporting tool, but we do want to gather all of this data. And then after you have that opportunity to talk through all those issues, then you will be asked what happened in your incidents and what you wish would have happened. What resources would you have liked to have had to get a different or better outcome? And what can we as public historians do to make things better, right, going forward? Because that's the ultimate goal, right? And out of the survey, we will analyze the results when we have them. The survey will be open for at least a couple of months, so you have some time. But once we have the data, we're going to be analyzing it, writing reports, doing presentations like this, and making suggestions for what we can do to move forward. I think a lot of those suggestions are going to revolve around policy issues. So let me, actually, maybe this is a good moment to share our poll question, which you can take, we'll just give you, 30 seconds or so to respond to this poll about whether your organization has policies around sexual harassment and gender discrimination. So the last couple of people who haven't voted, I'll give you just like 5 more seconds. All right. So let's take a look. So this is actually really interesting to me. So 63% of you who responded do have a policy at your place. For 26%, you don't, or you're not sure if you do. And then there's 13% who are working on a policy at the moment. So that suggests that there's some work to be done in your organizations around these issues. So is it time for us to do the breakout groups?
Yes, it is. We can we can break into groups now. So I'm going to set that up now.
Great. And then I've put a question up on the slide for you to discuss in your groups, right? So given what we've talked about today, do you think that your institution's policies are sufficient to address these problems? Of course, if your institution doesn't have these policies yet, then that's its own issue, right? So I think talking as a group about how you would develop policies that would help prevent sexual harassment, gender discrimination would be a great use of the 15 minutes or so that you're going to have. And then I think there's a really deep question to be asked about whether policies are enough. Is that actually going to fix this problem? Okay, now I'm done.
Thank you, Mary. And I just want to let people know that the even though the session is being recorded, the breakout groups do not get recorded, so that you can hopefully feel free to talk during that that time about your organization specifically, if you want to. But just so you know, the breakout groups do not get recorded.
Okay, I'm going to open the breakout rooms now. And you can discuss amongst yourselves the policies that you have in your organizations, or if not, what you would like to see. And it's an open, informal discussion. So I'm going to open all the rooms now. And at the end, if perhaps you can pick one person who can describe what you discussed or pose questions that you have for Mary, that would be very helpful when you come back in. So this will be for 15 minutes. I'm going to open all the rooms now. Okay, so everyone should be back now. I'm going to hand it over to Mary Rizzo to conduct a discussion of the possible questions you may have, or what types of topics you discussed, what was interesting to you to discover in your groups, and any questions you have for Mary that you would like to pose. You could also pose questions in the chat. You're welcome to do that. So Mary, if you'd like to take it over.
Sure, absolutely. And I'd say the conversation that I was a part of was really interesting and brought up some really important issues. So I'm very curious to hear what other people talked about. I think this can be very loose. So, I believe we only have about 10 minutes until the official end of the session. I'm certainly able to stick around for like another 10 or 15 minutes after that. So if people do want to talk to me specifically, happy to do that. What did people talk about in your group discussions? I don't want to be all professorial and call on people. So yeah, what did you guys talk about? Oh no, you're all shy. Louise,
I'll hop in here. We had a really nice group discussion, and we went through your questions kind of just starting off with, policies and are they enough, and came to the point of like enforcement and training, and that's really hard. And just in the museum field, things are so competitive. Like, how do you support staff coming forward? Like, if you have policies in place, what then do you do with the policies? You know, are they enforced? Does all the staff know about them? Do they know who to report to? Do they know their options for reporting? And one question we talked about is what would make staff more willing to come forward? Having a guaranteed job, knowing that they weren't going to face any negative kind of professional performance kind of retribution to it. Building up trust with your staff and showing that you're committed to the policies, that they're not just policies on paper, but that there's a commitment to the policies from very high levels of leadership. And one thing that came up at the very end, which was great that Stephanie shared, was bystander intervention training. That having, you know, kind of everyone involved with promoting a positive and safe workplace and setting the tone that we're not going to stand for microaggressions or for any kind of harassment or gender discrimination, and make it everyone's responsibility to promote that positive tone in the workforce. So those are some of the things that we touched on, and I say I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
That's awesome. You guys talked about a lot. You really used your time very well. I also want to just jump in. Kiki put into the chat something that I think actually echoes some of what you were saying, Louise. You know, this is the group that I was part of too, right? There was a really interesting discussion about, like, what's the point of reporting something if you don't think anything is actually going to happen, and that it might make things worse because now you're the person who reported the thing and there's no real way to change what happens afterwards, right? So retaliation is a possibility. It also just, like, you know, being that person who's like the outsider now because of what you did. So one of the questions that we really struggled with, frankly, right, is that, you know, what should happen after a report is filed? You know, we talked a little bit about restorative justice kind of models of less like punishment and also having community involved in, like, what, you know, what happens next. But it does point to the shortcomings of policy, like you guys were saying in your group, Louise, right? Like, policy isn't sufficient. Just having a policy is not sufficient.
So I'll speak for our group. We again also had a really interesting discussion, and was exciting for me to hear that both large and small organizations seem to have, in the two that were in our group that are from New Jersey, had policies in place. So I'm very encouraged by that. But I think also we brought up, there were some ideas brought up or you know, kind of points brought up that had to do with, for example, I know these are both history organizations that organize this, but if you think about gallery spaces, galleries do not have any of this stuff in place, it seems. And that doesn't protect not only their staff, if they have any staff, but volunteers who work there or interns. And so again, it's this vulnerability at the younger level. I know that you mentioned that wasn't the case Stephanie mentioned it wasn't the case in the research, but I just think that's important to start the process of letting people know about it at that level, as well as at the higher levels. Also, there were, we were talking about gender and the fact that a lot of the people on the call are either, you know, if they're women, that then it's different than if you're men, and that in a male-dominated field such as public history and or museums. How can that group of people be educated and become aware of what the issues are? So the different age groups, the idea of men, and that in galleries, there's just kind of like a whisper system, not only about the people that are working there or interning there, but also the artists. And what do you do about showing an artist who, how do you explain to them, I'm not going to show your work because you're, you know, there's these issues or incidents that have been associated with you. How does that influence one's career? As an intern or as a volunteer or a gallery owner. And so it seems like it has to extend beyond the museum and public space to broader public spaces that are, you know, art and even park service state park type places. Although being that if it's a state or a national, as you mentioned with National Park Service, it's a different standard because it's either federal or state government. But we had some, you know, trying to think also about how museums could create the space as much like Louise was saying, or the ability to make people feel safe talking about these. So it's our responsibility to try to create that.
Those are all incredible points. Really appreciate it. And it made me, and I think like sort of piggybacking off of that, one of the points that I had wanted to make, and I think I like glanced over it because I was, you know, rushing, is one of the challenges of public history work and, you know, work in museums is, of course, you're always interfacing with the public. So where that also then puts you in the position of being possibly harassed or discriminated against as well, right? So there are plenty of stories out there of, you know, like tour guides, for example, you know, leading a tour of a historic site, getting harassed or having like racist things said to them, etc. And so that adds another level of complexity because you're not just dealing with employees that you may have some power over, but you also have to think about like, how do you work with the public? And then I think to add another layer to that, that also makes it very complex is, all of our institutions run because of relationships that we've built and nurtured over long periods of time, whether that's with board members or with members of the public or with institutions in the community. And if one of those relationships turns out to be a toxic relationship, how do you deal with that? Because you've nurtured that relationship for years. Your institution has. How do you get rid of that person, or how do you break that relationship? And it, you know, I think it dovetails with what you're saying about like the gallery and the artist relationship, right? That can have serious consequences. So there are all of these levels of complexity where we're also talking about the interface with the public in all of these kinds of different ways. Yes. Oh, right. Independent contractors and freelancers. Totally. Absolutely. And so this is one of the things with the survey that we're trying to gather some information on. So, you know, we're asking folks about their, you know, who they are, right, demographically, but also the kinds of institutions they're working in, because one of our concerns is like, how do we deal with institutions of different sizes, of different, like if they have HR or not? And also, how do we deal with people at different stages of their career and also in different kinds of careers within public history? And maybe the world of the independent contractor is very different than what someone who is in a management position at a large museum is experiencing. Yes, please fill out the survey and share it with all of your networks and your institutions.
Okay, I think we're running out of time, Mary. So, but if people want to stay on beyond the 3:30 mark, we have allotted an extra 15 minutes. That is a good question, Claudia.
Let me just take 10 yeah. seconds to respond to
okay,
that.
Okay, certainly.
So, I'm sorry about that, but survey results. So what's going to happen is when we have finished the survey, right, the data from the survey will be available to a very small number of people associated with the National Council on Public History and the ASLH. Out of that, we will write a report, at least one report, and possibly more than one, and we will share those reports and information from those surveys through definitely through our blog. The National Council on Public History blog is called History at Work. There will probably be other kinds of publications that come out of it as well. You should follow us on Twitter if you're a Twitter person, at NCPH, right, Stephanie? And probably also through conference presentations. Those are all different ways in which the survey results we shared. I wouldn't expect that until we just launched the survey, like last week, at least a couple of months for gathering data, so at least a few months beyond that. So I would say we're not until late in the spring or next summer before we'll have results. Thank you for giving me the time to share that.
Oh, certainly. So, I wanted to wrap it up for those of you who have to leave. We want to thank you, Mary Rizzo, and Stephanie Rowe, and Claudia Ocello for this thought-provoking program. And thank you for joining us today. For our NJAM Connections program. A recording will be made available soon. Be sure to check out the links in the chat for membership in NJAM and also the NCPH and AASLH survey that Mary has been talking about. Join us for our next program on Wednesday, October 21st at 2:30 for an informal virtual coffee break to chat and connect with friends and colleagues in the field. Look for our NJAM survey coming soon to your email so that we can find out and evaluate how we did with this program. For those of you who would like to continue the conversation, don't go away. There are an extra 15 minutes in this Zoom session, so we can talk informally. It won't be recorded. And for those who are leaving, until next time, and goodbye. So, all right, so thank you all for joining us today. And
Saskia, the discussion can be about, we can talk about anything. It doesn't have to just be about today's topic, right?
Sure, we can talk about anything, but I figured that I would allow people to pose questions to Mary if they like, or they can just talk informally and, you know, connect with colleagues. So I'm going to turn off the recording. Thank you and goodbye.